This episode of Red Inca, we look at whether first-class records are great predictors for batting success in the test game. So I got on someone who'd just written about that recently.
I'm Jack Hope, and I'm one-third of the Cricket Podcast.
We look at stats, scouts, conditions, preparation, why players average more in tests than first-class sometimes, and also the whole Vaughan-Truscothic anomaly. I wanted to get you on, mate, so we could talk about first-class batting and test batting, because it's certainly been, I think, with the rise in analytics and the way that we look at cricket now, beforehand it was like, well, he's averaging 45 in first-class cricket, so we better pick him for the test team. Whereas now we've gone to a whole nother level, and you wrote a blog post on your, what's your Substack? What's it called?
Oh, I think it's thecricketpod.substack or something like that.
I said that because I didn't want to get it wrong and you couldn't even remember it. But you wrote a piece about first-class batting and how it transfers to the test level. It's something that I've written about at times before. There's been some other really good writers who have done it as well. But let's just start with, if you're good at first-class batting, there is at least a very high percentage chance that you'll be good at test match batting. There's nothing in anyone's numbers that sort of say that's not the case.
Yes and no. I think you're more likely.
Batting
is the way I would put it. I think there's a decent chance you won't be good at test match batting. But if you're not good at first class cricket, there is a very, very low chance that you'll be good at test match batting.
That's much better put than what I meant. But yeah, I think it's still one of the best bits of information that we have. And I think most of the players who fail at test level probably have failed through other situations. If they are top level players anyway, back in the old days, you know, you'd have a first class average of 50, but you could, was it Hick that was dropped at the end of his first series? And so confidence then becomes an issue, but it's really interesting. So when I checked, around 30% of batters average more at the test level than they do at first class level, which sounds like a huge stat. But facilities being picked in your prime and often being dropped at the first sign of weakness all play a real big part in that. So there's no doubt that you have to make runs at first class level. Did you have a look at any players who sort of haven't played cricket? Who haven't made runs at first class level who've been thrown into test cricket?
I mean, there are a few, you know, knocking around. I guess, to ask a question back to your question, what is the threshold at which you haven't scored runs at first-class cricket or in first-class cricket? Because I think within the current England team, you could probably make the argument that Zach Crawley is not necessarily produced at a first-class level to the extent that you would say he is good at first-class cricket. I mean, he is passable at first-class cricket, you'd say. He has shown he has potential in first-class cricket, but he is in the test team in the test squad as we speak. So the answer is sort of. There isn't a vast number of players that have poor track records in first class cricket that have had extended spells in test teams, right?
Yeah, no, there aren't. I mean, I remember when I looked at I think I've got these numbers right. There is almost no players who average 10% more at first class cricket than they do at almost no players who average 10% more at test cricket than they do of their first class numbers, other than a few outliers like, you know, Adam Vogt just comes in and occasionally you will get a player like that who has a short career. But over a long period of time, you're much more likely to obviously average around 30% less in test cricket than you do in first class cricket. And there's a lot of players sort of bungled into the middle. And there's a lot of guys out there, as I said before, that average a few runs extra. You know, and we'll come to Michael Vaughan and Truscothic later on because we have to talk about them because otherwise every single comment on this podcast will be about them. But as a general rule, if you play a long test career, chances are that you will average around your first class numbers, but probably just slightly lower. And that makes sense, doesn't it? It is harder.
Absolutely does. I mean, I think it might be worth me explaining why I was interested in writing this about this in the first place. So, you know, through the Cricket Podcast, we cover cricket and we talk about what happened in the cricket, what might happen in the cricket, why it happened and why it might happen and why something might happen in the future. So, you know, coming at it from that angle, looking at the game from that perspective, yeah, I, and I think the other guys on the podcast, have a suspicion that England's selection process for Test cricket has some flaws. Mm-hmm. So I tested that, and what I did was I mapped the England Test batters' performance in first class cricket versus their performance in Test matches. And what we find from that fundamentally is that there is a link. But I think the thing to bear in mind, you know, more broadly here is that link is not perfect. It's actually quite a weak link. If someone averages 50 in first class cricket, there's not, you know, I think you're more likely than not to average significantly fewer. Significantly fewer, possibly, you know, 20, 30 runs fewer in some cases. I mean, if you look at players in the current England team, Bairstow's one of them, Pope's one of them. We've talked about Hick already. Rob Key, I think, was another that had a huge drop off. So I think when we're talking about this, when we're talking about first class performance and how that maps to Test matches, I think we should look at it more from the perspective of first class performance being an indicator of what a player's likely ceiling will be. As you said, very, very few players score more runs in Test matches or average higher in Test matches. So yes, I think you want to approach this from the point of view of establishing what a player's ceiling may be. I'd probably go as far as saying, I think when I published this piece, Nathan Lehman commented or tweeted back or replied along the lines of saying that he didn't think it was a particularly useful indicator, batting average in first class cricket. And I think the more I've thought about this, the more I have come to sympathise with that point of view. Although I do think, as I said, first class average can provide a useful indicator in terms of ceiling. Does that make sense? Does that sort of, you know, set the scope of what I was looking into?
It does. I think that what I have seen is we've never seen a player become a good replacement level Test match batter without the ability to make runs in red ball cricket consistently before that mark. So that would be my point with James Vince. That would be my point with Zach Crawley, being that you're looking at this from England. You can look at this from an absolute ton of West Indian batting talents over the last 20 years. They come in with low first-class batting averages, clearly with a lot of talent, right? But if you don't know, and you could put Owen Morgan in this. There's a lot of different players out there in this sort of basket. If you do not know how to make runs consistently against the red ball, to think that they're going to be able to do it at the higher level is, I think, almost setting players up to fail. And what your research says, I think when you're talking about the ceiling there, it's a very, very interesting thing, because I think a lot of those players are probably coming in with incredibly low ceilings because of this. And maybe that's what hasn't been looked at. We look at, you know, and Nathan Lehman is right. There are many other interesting things to look at. I mean, Andrew, I almost said Andrew Hildreth. I mean, James Hildreth, don't I? James Hildreth, the Somerset batter, you know, up until about a week ago, every time there was a spot in the England middle order, he, you know, a Somerset fan would pop up on a comment telling you he should be in the side. Now, his batting average was quite good. What was it, mid-40s? You know, certainly higher than a lot of the England players. But when you actually start to delve into his batting average, it was very home versus away. If all tests were played at Taunton, I would definitely think about, you know, picking him in my side. And I think that's also where I think Nathan Lehman, he talked about the Simpson paradox in your particular work, if I saw that correctly. And I think that's where Nathan Lehman is right. There's a lot more than just batting average that anyone would ever have to worry about. It's just kind of a starting point.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's very well put. Starting point is definitely. You know, the first screener that I think you'd want to apply if you were looking at who should be in your test team. But then beyond that, you sort of touch on it there. There's so much we don't know and we don't look at the moment. And I think that's what we sort of need to be considering. You know, like we're having a conversation here about how do we predict the future? Yeah, based on an imperfect sample of data that we have about the past. It's very, very difficult. But yeah, you know, like read the blog post. You can see quite clearly the first class batting averages give you a pretty strong indication of where a likely ceiling will be for a player. This, by the way, it's replicated. So I had a look. Interesting you talk about the West Indies. I looked at the big three. So beyond this, the article itself, it just focuses on England because that was the story I wanted to tell. But after Nathan Lehman raised this point, I did have a look at the same things in India and Australia. India, very similar story to England in terms of players not getting better when they break into Test cricket. Most of them 10, 15 runs worse, some of them quite a lot worse than that. Australia is slightly different. And I think this would probably reflect what a lot of people assume about first-class cricket in Australia. In Australia, there is a bit more of a close link between a batter's performance in first-class cricket and their likely performance in Test cricket. And we actually see more Australian batters perform better and sometimes significantly better in Test cricket than they do in the Shield. Now, I'd speculate, and I think you probably agree, that is because Shield cricket is a higher standard than the Ranji or County Championship cricket.
It's also probably age dependent, would be my other guess there. I think a lot of those numbers might be, Adam Voges and Brad Hodge and Mike Hussey, Chris Rogers. Do you know what I mean? If those guys are coming in later, and Australia probably over the last, 20, 25 years has done that a lot. Even if you look back to the 90s, Langer and Hayden and all those guys came in early, and Martin, and then they went and got very good, and then they came back when they perfected their techniques. Other teams maybe haven't done that as much. With India, it's almost, if you're not 22 and the best batting prospect in the country, chances are you will be overlooked. You can have a look at the Vihari or Abhinav Mukund. There's plenty of guys with ridiculous records that just haven't gone on. And England is something else completely different. And that's what I want to get back to, because this is about English cricket, we can focus on that. But Australia probably is a very good version of this too. If you're good at first-class cricket in England, that means you're good at a particular kind of first-class cricket. That does not mean that you are ready, set up for test matches. So the best way of putting this is, I did the numbers earlier this year. Syderabad, Taunton, is the 50 most spinniest wicket in the world. And by that, I mean the most amount of spin bowled, 50th. And it's by far and away the most in the UK. But it's not even close. I think Old Trafford has the second most spin bowled at it. And it's probably not in the top 80, right? So you can be an absolute gun first-class cricketer in England and not be set up to actually succeed outside of England. And that is the case in most first-class setups because of the way that pitches are.
Yeah, and I think that's where it would be really interesting to take the sort of next step and have a look at some of the smaller factors or the smaller numbers behind the big number, the batting average number, that make that up. And if you like, map which of those are better indicators that somebody will maintain their average going into Test cricket. So, we know there's a high likelihood of failure. We know that someone who looks quite good in first-class cricket is probably not going to be good in Test cricket. I think you could basically say that. It's harsh, but that's the sort of reality. But within those numbers, there should be, or I would speculate quite strongly here, that there will be indicators that give you a better idea and help you to forecast better when you look at players making that step. Now, for English players, it might be their ability against spin. That could be maybe the first place you look. So you screen who has the best batting average in first-class cricket. Then you look a level below, what type of bowlers they're scoring their runs against. If it's right arm medium pace, they're averaging 80 against right arm medium pace and 20 against anyone who bowls spin. Well, they're probably not going to succeed, particularly away from home in international cricket.
Well, it's also the Ollie Pope one. I remember Gareth Batty and Mark Butcher were furious at me. We were in South Africa and TalkSport said, try and work out the weakness of Ollie Pope. And I went through the numbers and he didn't have a lower batting average against spin, right? So I was like, okay, that's not a weakness. And then I just happened to flick at my eye and I went, what's his strike rate against spin in first-class cricket? And I can't remember what it was off the top of my head, but it was low. It was very low considering the kind of bowlers he was facing in first-class cricket in England and how little he faced it. And I was like, oh, that's going to be a problem. They haven't, no one's got him out yet, but he's not going to be able to score against international spinners, especially when he gets to Asia. Now, fast forward now and I look like a genius, but those are the sorts of things that you need to look beyond his average. With Ollie Pope's remarkable, isn't it? Because we know that if a pitch is anywhere like the oval and has any sort of pace or carry in it, he's very hard to get out. But in any other situation, it seems like he may not, and he should develop, because you can't be, I don't think you can be that good. There aren't that many single usage batters. Do you know what I mean? Most players have the ability to develop that further. But that's what we're really talking about here, isn't it? You start with the first class average, as you said, then you have a look at the average versus spin. Then you might have a look at the average by types of bowling. If you're very good at facing 80 mile an hour right arm seam, that's great. But that's not really what Test match cricket is anymore. Unless you come across Mohammed Abbas or there's a couple of them, but there aren't that many guys out there like that. So you really are looking for those other key indicators, which can be quite tough. I mean, Shreyas Iyer, off the top of my head, has played 3 first class games outside of Asia. It's not too many more than that anyway. Shreyas Iyer, really, by this stage in his career, should have just been sent everywhere. He should have played a year of county cricket, and he should have played club cricket in Australia, whatever he has to have done to be able to develop. But that's not how current Indian cricket is set up. So even if you have a talent as great as him, and we've just seen how brilliant he was in Kanpur, he's not being set up to succeed. He's going to have to go through the same problems that everyone else has had to go through. And that might mean that he might have his average might drop. Because he might fail in a bunch of overseas tests, and then he's left out of the team, even if he's the most talented player. Like, we're not completely setting these guys up to be prepared for what they need to be prepared for, I think is the way I'm putting it.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And I think part of that is because we just don't address those underlying points. You're talking about Ollie Pope and noticing that his strike rate was lower against spin. I wonder whether anybody had seriously looked into that until you mentioned that. Shreyas Iyer, it's obvious, he has the talent to be a fantastic test level player. But to some extent, he's going into test match cricket now, hamstrung by the fact that he will not be a well-rounded global cricketer, if you like. And this probably explains to some extent why we see these huge drop-offs in performance. Because the game is so, so much different between first-class cricket, wherever you are in the world, and what you have to do in test cricket, which involves playing, in at least 3 quite distinct playing conditions or at least 3 different types of pitch. Probably way more. But if you wanted to really generalize, maybe you could say Asian conditions, English conditions, and sort of Australian, South African conditions.
Yeah.
Don't quite know where the West Indies falls into that theory of cricket.
Well, West Indies, I always thought that was maybe one reason West Indies produced very rounded batters back in the day. That hasn't stayed with us. But because they have a variety of different pitches, I always thought that was a natural advantage to them. Doesn't seem to be anymore, but back in the day. But I did a video on Ashwin recently and him against left-handers, and Ed Cowan came up, and I might eventually do. Ed Cowan's career is quite interesting because I don't think Ed Cowan was ever going to average much more than 40 in test cricket. I think that is probably about his ceiling in test cricket if everything went his way. But he ran into R. Ashwin, who happens to be the greatest bowler to left-handers of all time. And I'll have to remember the stats from my video, but 13% of his career deliveries in test cricket were to the guy who's the best at dismissing left-handers, right? And he dismissed him a lot. That's unfortunate matchup there, right? The other thing that happened with Ed Cowan's career is he also went to the West Indies. And I can't remember if it was when they first started using the Duke's balls or if it was just a particular series where no one made any runs. And you realize how often people fail in test cricket and end up with those lower averages than what you would expect them to have is a bad matchup early on and maybe a series or a conditions that don't suit the way that they play or doesn't suit the way that anyone plays. It's so removed from first class cricket. So the other thing, in fact, it was Ed Cowan who told me this once. He said that it wasn't until he got to test cricket he realized what it was like to have a real matchup. Like, he faced Zahir Khan in the 3rd innings. So he faced him twice, I think, in Melbourne. And then he went to Sydney and faced him. And he saw in Zahir Khan's eyes that Zahir Khan had worked him out. And he suddenly went, oh, God, this doesn't happen. This doesn't happen when you play counter cricket. This doesn't happen when you play shield cricket. You only play these guys twice a year. They don't have a chance to, even if they've worked you out in the first game, it's 4 months. It might be 4 months before they bowl to you again, right? Or they don't have time to prepare and think about it. The actual games are so set up so differently. So pitches usually favour bowlers more in first-class cricket because they're four-day pitches and they kind of have to. The facilities are terrible. The training facilities are worse. The third, fourth and fifth bowlers, whether it be, you know, second, third change or whether it just be the third, fourth and fifth most talented bowlers on any team, are complete drop-offs compared to what you face at Test cricket. I'm trying to think, was it Shaun Masood was on my podcast and he was talking about when you're... it was Abhinav Mukund was talking about when you're in Test cricket, when you're in first-class cricket, you basically, you overcome the best bowlers, right? And you tire them out and you get past them and you get set. And then they bring on the replacements. And you're like, great, this is the time to cash in. And when you play Test cricket, oh, I have to do the same thing to the next level bowler and then the next level bowler. It never goes away. It is just a fundamentally different thing than it would be almost impossible for any first-class system to really replicate what Test cricket is.
Yeah, and moving beyond data, this is where there needs to be a role for people who are specialist cricket watchers, if you like, scouts, to try and figure out which players do have the transferable skills. Because, you know, we can. I mean, you know, for example, we could overcome some of these things. We could look at which players in county cricket perform well against international quality bowlers. There are quite a few international quality bowlers knocking around the county circuit. It would be possible to, you know, look at the ball-by-ball data for the overs they bowl and see which batters perform well. You know, you marry that up with people who have good averages overall and you've probably got an international level player there. Mm. But there are other skills that are, I suppose, slightly less tangible. And I think if we use, let's go back to Pope and playing at spin. I think there are quite a lot of batters in England who play spin based on the line rather than the length. Now, I think in Test cricket, the best players to spin, they play way back or they play way forward. You can look at the Hawkeye data for this. You can read Ben Jones's book, and this is explained. If you watch somebody like Pope play spin, he effectively plays down the line of the ball because when he plays spin in first class cricket, when he's played spin when he was a kid, he was probably playing somebody who's in the team really to balance things out. Bat number eight. Average 25, 30, get through a few overs when the ball's 50 overs old, hopefully at under three and over. Not really an attacking switch. There's a big difference between that and Ashwin. There's a big difference between...
And that's before you factor in the pitches as well. The pitch is probably not set up for that guy because he's a part-timer and they don't care.
So, you know, within the raw numbers, you might see that Pope doesn't score quickly but doesn't get out to spin in England. Now, somebody who's watched a bit more cricket, someone who is a scout, might be able to pick up on the weakness in someone's game that won't transfer through to Test cricket. And I think I talked about this in the article, but I used baseball as the example and the Oakland A's. The Oakland A's, Billy Beane's Moneyball, the book Moneyball, the reason they won is because three pitchers who aren't really mentioned in the book were amazing. Barry Zito, Mark Mulder and Tim Hudson. They contributed about 80% of their wins above average accumulation over that season. It's not a particularly sexy story, that part of the Moneyball story. What happened is a scout, I think he's called Fat Scout in the book, Joe Poloni. He went and he saw these guys and said, you know, they've got a major league level splitter. So if we get them and work on their control for a couple of years, we'll have a top level pitcher. Not mentioned in the book because it doesn't fit that particular narrative, but that's effectively why Moneyball was successful in its first iteration. Billy Beane from there. Sorry, I had to catch a fly. Just
go. You're clapping yourself, man.
Billy Beane from there, obviously, has been at the forefront of data in sport and has really driven that, and is it's rightly regarded as a genius on that front. But to boil all of that down into one point, there has to be room in the proverbial room for the fat scout who can say that is Test quality or that is major league quality, and that isn't. Because we can't, the data as it exists at the moment, I know Amal Desai, who was talking about this on your podcast, I was listening back to that, the data as it exists at the moment, in cricket especially, is not complete enough for us to be able to do things like predict who will be good in Test cricket versus from just their performance at a lower level.
Well, it's funny that you talked about Sheffield Shield compared to the other two systems before. Essentially, Sheffield Shield's probably one of the few systems that is set up partly by accident, let's be honest, to actually be good at setting up people for Test cricket. That's not necessarily what the Ranji Trophy was set up for. It's certainly, the county game was set up before Test cricket, right? It was not set up at all to help Test players. In fact, it's still not set up to...
No, it's not.
England got better by pulling their players out of county cricket. That was part of the thing, making them professional, you know. And so it makes sense. And if you look at it realistically at cricket, none of it is set up to make the players the best that they can be, right? The entire system all the way up to Test level is not made up to do that. It's a hodgepodge system that no one would come up with anymore. So, of course, it's flawed. I want to talk about the scouts. I think that... Here's my thing with scouts. England cricket is coming up with scouts. I know Mike Hendrick was a scout for England with their fast bowlers, and they've used wicket-keeping scouts and spin bowling scouts, all these guys out there to go and have a look at it. They did that after they got the data because they realized that they needed to fill the gap in, right? And if you look at old school selection, you'd have a couple of batters, maybe a bowler if you're lucky there, who don't see that much cricket, who were making a bunch of ill-informed decisions. They were out of the game. And quite often, I remember having a really good chat with, might have been John Inverarity about, I can't remember what it was, but it was a particular skill, and they didn't have that skill on the selection committee at the time. And I said, I'm not being rude, but what makes you an expert on that over a fast bowler who, you know, knows exactly what that guy's doing? And you don't really know exactly what that guy's doing because you never had to do it yourself, or you've never researched it because your job was batting and spin bowling. And he was like, no, you're probably right. The whole system doesn't really make sense. And that's a very John Inverarity thing. He was chairman of selectors, I think, at the time. It's a very John Inverarity thing to say, though, of this, like, oh, now you've said that, the system doesn't work. And the selection system has never worked. What scouts in Moneyball, the reason that they were flawed, even though they had success in the particular cases you're talking about, the reason that scouts were flawed is because it was the only system, right? It's the ability to marry these things up. And what cricket did was we kind of skipped scouts, which is a very smart thing to do. We're going to get experts who understand this thing. We're going to send them on the road to go and have a look at everyone. And then they're going to come back with some information on all these different players. And we're going to decide on the player that fits our plans. That's how sport should be. And then all it needed to do is have that marrying with actual analytics of, well, wait a minute, you've said that, but what you've seen this about him, but we now need to get him in a machine and see what his numbers do to be able to do that. But in cricket, we kind of just skipped scouts altogether. And that is probably one of the bigger issues that we have. And, you know, but this is not just an international thing. I know guys who try and get first class setups. I've got a friend who, he's so frustrated. He'll play against a guy who's really good and he knows his cricket and played first class cricket himself, and he'll send their phone number to someone. And the first class teams don't even have time to call the guy up and tell him to come in for a trial. There's no proper scouting within sort of professional cricket below the proper level. And then we have entire selection committees where no one actually watches enough first class cricket to ever make any proper decisions anyway.
Yeah, you've nailed basically all of the things that I'd noted down as possible contributors to why we as a collective, I mean, not you and I, but why people are not making...
Why Jared and Jack have failed cricket.
Well, they're making mistakes and picking players that go into test teams that don't produce. Now, sometimes that will just happen, you know, the whole... spectrum of human performance and thought processes and like the Ed Cowan example, just getting unlucky a few times. Sometimes you will have failures, but we do seem to have a lot, and we seem to have quite a lot in England. And I think, you know, coupling a less than ideal, I think, first class system, if you're looking at it from the perspective of, is it producing test quality players? Is it an arena in which people can improve their skills to become test match players? I don't think it really is that. It's something else, and it might be good at that. It might be good at providing entertainment for retirees. But it's not the Sheffield Shield, if you like. Then you layer on top of that a poor selection process that is either made up of people who are basically just speculating. Let's be honest here. The 1990s style,
yeah,
England selection panel was just like, let's guess. We're not going to use any data. We're not really going to do any scouting. We're going to pick 11 names and have a gin and tonic. Then we sort of gone to this slightly more data-driven way of looking at things, but yeah, neglected the actually, can we look at this player and see if they're any good? Or you talk about Sam Robson quite regularly on different podcasts as a player who you could see would not be successful in Test cricket because he had a flaw. Now, you would hope that a good scouting system would have picked that up before you used 10% of your resources in the team on Sam Robson.
Do you know what? It's really interesting you point that out, because even before that, what you would hope is if they had thought he was, because he had a lot of other test skills, right? Incredible patience. He was a very, very straight bat. You know, he had things that should have transferred to test cricket. He just didn't have the one thing you need in test cricket, which is that the ability to handle the ball just outside off stump, right? Which hilariously now doesn't matter as much because everyone bowls at the stumps. So maybe he'd be good now. But the other question is we're talking about, so money, the reason that Moneyball is flawed for me is not that they overcame not that they didn't talk about the pitches, because I already figured that there would be good players on a team. And really what they were trying to do is they were showing how, when you lose three incredible players, how you build up that with using analytics. The problem for me with Moneyball is it's assuming that players don't learn and that players can't develop. And players are incredible at evolving during their career to stay relevant. Because if they don't, they disappear. That's why you don't have many guys who, like, at the age of 26, just disappear from test cricket and never seen again, or first-class cricket, having made a lot of runs before that. Even if the game has changed, they evolve slowly with the game. So realistically, with Sam Robson, what should have been is, I shouldn't have been the only person who's picked that up, and I'm sure there are England analysts who did that. They should have gone back and worked with him to be like, okay, if we can fix this, you could probably average 40 opening the batting for us for the next 10 years. And that's more than enough in England, and we'll take that. And if we lose patience with you in the future, we apologize in advance. I wonder if those conversations are also something that is not happening. So that, again, analytics and scouting is really handy to go back to the player and go, this is what we've noticed. This is why we think you'll work in test cricket, and this is why we think you won't work in test cricket. Is this something that you would like to work on with us? I feel like that is sometimes missed within international cricket.
I think it's missed very consistently. Again, I mean, I am looking at this from an England-centric point of view. I know more about the England team. I see more of their matches. I have a better knowledge, although it's not a great knowledge, I'd admit, of the first-class system in England than
really
I do.
Really selling your podcast here, man.
Yeah. But let's take a current example, Dom Sibley. So he's made it into the international team off the back of three or four very good seasons. Now, there are things that Dom Sibley does that clearly are test quality. He has immense powers of concentration. You know, he's got excellent judgment. And then there are things that he does that, you know, you look at and you're surprised that he played professional cricket at all, to be honest. Now, surely at some point, if Dom Sibley was on track to play test cricket and the data at the first class level would suggest that he was, somebody should have gone to see Dom Sibley and maybe suggest he learnt like one shot for the offside. Doesn't need loads. Just
the one, Dom. other than your outside edge, which we're very happy that you've managed to, you know, beat slips occasionally with, if you could just, in front of point, find a shot.
But yeah, so there's... Failure might be too strong a word, because is it really the responsibility of the England team to go round all of the counties, find all of the potential England players and micromanage their games in that way? Or should someone like Dom Sibley recognise that he's not hitting the ball through the offside ever and address that himself?
Now, this is where I'm just going to interject quietly and then you go on with your point. But Dom Sibley doesn't know what is going to be successful in test cricket when he's young Dom Sibley, right? He only knows that when he's been there. So realistically, it is the job of someone to say, okay, this is working here, but you're about to go to another level and things are going to change. And this is why we want you to think about it. If he says, oh, I'm good, fair enough. And if you still want to pick him, you pick him and you see how it goes. That's all I would say about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, and that's a fair point. But I think what I would say is that that process needs to be defined one way or the other. To run... And all of these questions, all of these general points that we're talking about here, they go back to processes. So how you select your team, what processes you have there, how you scout future prospects and develop those players, what processes have you got in place there. Now to the most extreme extent here, you can have it one of two ways. You can either make it the responsibility of players to do this all themselves and make that clear, or you can you can do take on a more micromanagey or be on a more micromanagey footing, where you have your list of 30 prospects, say, and you explain to them why they're not test level at the moment, what the expert, the scout, the coach, whoever it is who's responsible for this, why, where they've identified they need to improve, and you work with them to improve them. That you know, if we go back to the very first point, these processes not being in place are why we see drop-offs. I would speculate. Now, I don't know this for sure. I will say that. It's a really, really tricky topic. I mean, when you invited me on to talk about it, I was like, there's not... what I would love to have been able to do is come on and say, this is how you should pick your test team. You just use this data. But there is no magic number. We know that. You know, it's not... First class cricket and test cricket, they're not the same thing. So performance in one does not equal performance in the other. It's only, as things exist at the moment, it's only a mild indicator, really. But yeah, so it's the general point, I think, that I try and get across is that you need these processes, be it in selection or in talent or in your talent pathways. And I don't think, you know, the story I would tell on this is I don't think the processes are there. And I think, or if they are there, they could be better.
So we're going to finish with Vaughan Truscothick, just to quiet the reply guys when this goes up. But also because they are the people, every time I've ever been asked by non-Crick Info people to write about cricket and data and analytics, they always say, oh yeah, can you just cover the Vaughan Truscothick thing? Like, I'm told that every single time. And so I'm going to go with Truscothick, and I'll let you come in with Vaughan a little bit more. If you go through Truscothick's numbers and you don't just look at his batting average, it is quite clear that he was an above average batting talent. A lot of his scores, he would score like, Somerset would be bowled out for 120 and he'd make 70, but with a strike rate of like 85, right? And you start looking at this and go, well, wait a minute, how come no one else could score runs? And not only was he scoring runs, but he's scoring runs at a high strike rate. And he did it again and again in collapses where no one else could score runs, or in low totals where he scored the bulk of the runs. It was quite clear that if you looked beyond just the basic level of his batting average, and this is, we don't have full first-class records in the 90s. This is me just going through scorecards one after the other and going, something about him, it clearly should have popped to them, even if it didn't for them. Vaughan is slightly different in that I would say Vaughan is a perfect example of a player who's picked almost exactly at his prime, even if that was accidental. And then he was dropped at the right at the point where he was probably regressing a little bit to his mean. He was picked exactly, he played test cricket exactly in his best batting years, would be the way I would put Vaughan. But you had a bit of a look at him as well.
I think what you say about Truscothick probably applies to some extent for Vaughan too. And vice versa, what you were saying about Vaughan there applies to Truscothick. Both of these players, I think, were picked at 25, which is almost perfect. I think if you look... I had a look into this to separate to the article, but I looked at batting average for players each year into their career. And something like 6-7 years into your career is when you stop improving and start to plateau.
Yeah.
Vaughan and Truscothick both started playing first-class cricket when they were young, like a lot younger than average. They got picked for the test team at that kind of sweet spot age, both in terms of, you know, how old they are and athletic development and so on, but also having that those 5-6 years of experience learning the game, being a professional cricketer behind them, and then both of them had premature ends to their careers, so they didn't have the, you know, the Ian Bell couple of years where he averaged 20. Which
the Ricky Ponting sunset.
Yeah, it just wasn't something that happened for them. And then finally, and we are actually talking about, you know, only a reasonably marginal overperformance from these two.
Yeah.
It's not like they average 80 in test cricket or 40 in first class cricket. I think, you know, I'm just getting up here. I haven't got the exact number. Vaughan is about 6 runs, I think, and Truscothick's maybe 3 or 4.
Yeah, my memory is that Vaughan was one of those players who was around the 10% mark better in test cricket than first class cricket. And Truscothick was actually far more normal when you look at the numbers. I was shocked because I would have thought he would have been up there as well. And they're not as much an out. When you look at the overall data, they're not the outliers. Maybe they're the outliers because England had been so bad and suddenly you had two players who had a couple of incredible moments in cricket. And in Truscothick's case, and Vaughan's case, they're also pretty to watch. You know, they were quite dynamic. They came at the same period, but realistically, this has happened before. It just happens to be that the England narrative and the press sort of took over. But you can't judge numbers. And it's like, well, you can if you get the right numbers. We might not get the right numbers, but we could maybe get closer to the right numbers.
A final thing I'd maybe add on both of those is that they played in the batting era for...
That's a very good point. I like that. Oh, my God. I'm adding that to my...
It wasn't like now in England in 2005.
Yep.
You could score 400 in the first innings, and England did regularly. They had a good team.
When did they both come in? Was it 99 they came into the team?
99-2000.
So 99 to 2008 is probably almost the peak era, especially if you're a left-hander, in Truscott's case, that's a very, very good time to come in. They also... Both of them had phased out by the time DRS had changed the way that you had to bat, which obviously affected a lot of other people. Very, very good points. And we're not saying they're not talented. We're also not saying that the system didn't let them down, because if they were that good, there's almost something wrong with the county system that they almost got overlooked.
Yeah, for sure. But that's why I think they overperformed slightly. I mean, the other England players that did, Collingwood was around in the same era. Was better in Test cricket than First Class cricket. Probably had a similar career trajectory. I mean, I haven't got the specifics of when he first plays Test cricket in front of me, but I reckon it would have been 26, 27. Came in for that 2005, the final Ashes Test, didn't he? Then he had a run in the team. And similarly, didn't play until he was spectacularly old, went back and was playing for Durham. I think that pattern. Pryor, another one. Came into the team when he was 25, 26, performed above his first class record, then career was cut maybe a little bit short with injury. So there are reasons why some people might overperform their average. Maybe, you know, just from this discussion, one of the things we should talk about is picking players at 25 or 26 when you have a very good idea of how good they may or may not be, and they've had time to work on weaknesses at a lower level, instead of picking them at 20 and sort of hoping that you can take them on a world tour.
I think it's a really interesting thing, because if you know that someone is an above average batting talent from your scouts and your selectors and your coaches, or even if you're not using scouts, but just selectors and coaches, they know there's probably the best way to learn test batting is to bat in it. But it also means that you could have a Matt Renshaw type situation, or a Hasib. In fact, you wrote about Hasib Hamid, didn't you? You could have those sorts of situations where they're kind of thrown in and then they sort of get discarded at a certain point. His was obviously, you know, slightly more, less luck, but the same thing might happen with Zach Crawley, right? In some ways, the best way to learn Test cricket is to play it. If you're going to be a 10-year player like Joe Root or Steve Smith or, you know, those sorts of things. But if you're not quite at that level, and this is the hard one to decide, then picking them at 25, 26, 27, the Mike Hussey years, if you will, is probably a better sort of, a better system. But which players do you throw in to develop and which players do you wait? Because you can, you know, it's hard.
It is hard, but it's also hard to get better at batting if you're out all the time. That's effectively what's happening. People aren't developing game plans around seeing off the new ball and building a long innings or knowing which bowler they want to target, because some of these players in the England team, they're effectively going from crisis to crisis. They're never established in the side. They have glaring weaknesses that all the bowlers know about, so they have no time to work on anything except those. They lose a lot. It's I don't know. It doesn't seem like a very clever thing to do to me when you know there are trends that suggest playing a bit later in your career is better.
I'm going to finish with one final thing. I think if we've proven anything today, it is that it is and remains very hard to tell the future. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so messy, but they're my thoughts.
Thanks for listening to Red Inca. There is more information on my guests available in the show notes, including their Twitter profiles, if they have one. This is the important bit, though. Please review on Apple Podcasts or anywhere, really. Share it on all the social medias and just get it out there. If you can, act it out in plays on your balcony with your loved ones. This podcast is made possible by the people who support us at Patreon, so thanks to those who already do. And there is a link to Patreon in the show notes as well. Red Inca is made by me, Jared Kimber. Nick McCorriston makes everything sound better for your ears, and the theme tune is called The Prisoner by the Red Crickets.